If anyone's got a handle on the complexities of communicating via one of the world's 6,000 languages, it's John McWhorter. He's a linguist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. He told Steve Paulson the exact moment his career began.
I was about 4 years old, and I was taking a piano class, and I was having some sort of four-year-old romance with this girl in the class. And then one day, she ran outside after the lessons were over to her parents, and all of a sudden, she was talking, but I couldn't understand a word she was saying. And especially in the late 60s in Philadelphia, it was more possible than it would be now to be 4 or 5 years old and have never heard a language other than your own. I hadn't heard Spanish, hadn't heard Chinese. And for me, this remains the most profound shock I can ever recall having received in my life, that I could not communicate. I guess I've always been kind of hardwired for language, and this was just shocking to me. So I asked my mother, "Mom, what are they doing?" And she said, "They're speaking another language, Jughead." That was her nickname for me. And I said, "Well, why can't we do that?" And she went over and she asked them what they were speaking. They said, "We are speaking Hebrew." And she said, "They're speaking Hebrew, Jughead. Now can we go home?" And I said, "Well, why can't we speak Hebrew?" And she said, "Because we're not Jewish." And I was absolutely flabbergasted. I was frustrated because I felt like I had lost this little girl, and I felt somehow impotent. I felt like we had been somehow deprived in not speaking Hebrew in the home. And that's how it all began for me.
So that was the birth of the linguist there when you were 4 years old.
That literally was it. And I wound up getting from a rabbi who taught a Hebrew school in the building where I went to school a nice sheet with the Hebrew alphabet on it. And I still have that sheet in a frame. And I taught myself how to sound out that alphabet. And I didn't realize at the time that that did not mean that I knew the language. I didn't know what I was reading. I had no idea. But that held me for a few years. And then I kept on going with this hobby of teaching myself these other tongues.
Now, one thing that you say in your book, The Power of Babel, is that all of the world's languages come from one single language. And really, not that long ago, 150,000 years ago or so.
Yeah, that's an estimate. That's probably somewhere in the ballpark. Now, there are many linguists who would say that language emerged in more than one place. I personally disagree with them, and I think it's much more likely that there was one original language. And yeah, it had to have existed. It's almost certain to have existed in Eastern or perhaps Southern Africa, and it has since become 6,000 offshoots of itself.
What makes you think there was one original language?
Well, it follows, for one thing, from just basic logic. There are no human groups that we know of now, nor any that are in written history, that have not spoken, which suggests in itself that speaking is some sort of original trait of our species. And it's often been noticed that one of the things that seems to conclusively distinguish our species from any other is speech, human speech as we know it. And so it's reasonable to suppose that that trait is something which is to some extent genetically predisposed in our being. And as a result, if it's part of the species, we know from other kinds of evidence that Homo sapiens goes back somewhere between 150 and 200,000 years. As a result, by deduction, among other ways of thinking about it, one can imagine that there must have been one language and that it has since branched into many others.
So how did a single language become 6,000 different languages?
Well, what happens is that language inherently changes, and not just the slang, but the basic sounds and the basic shapes of words and even the way the grammar works. It changes bit by bit. It's often very hard to feel these things within an individual lifetime, but it does happen. Basically, any language is at all times on its way to transforming into a new language entirely. And so what happens is that if populations separate, then the language ends up going off in two different directions. You can't predict what change is going to happen in a language. You can just explain it. There are all sorts of choices that a language might make at any given place in its grammar or in terms of its sounds. So that means that if you have separate groups, then the rolls of the dice are going to be different with the two groups, and after a while, they will no longer be able to understand each other. Multiply that by 6,000 languages, and you can see how something like that would have happened.
You're really saying there's no such thing as a finished language. There's no final product. Every language is constantly changing, constantly evolving.
That's exactly true. And it kind of sheds a light on many people's sense that one form of language is better than another, or one language is better than another. So, for example, there was a time, we go back to the 800s, 900s, when there was a kind of Latin being spoken in what's now France, which was considered the crummy language of the people, and schoolmasters were upset that this language of the village or this language of the streets was getting further and further away from the kind of Latin that they were teaching in schools. We look back on samples of what they were talking about, and what we see is French. It was early French. And so there's no sense in which the French of today is somehow better than that intermediate point between Latin and French, which I often call Fratin, was. Really, our sense of these things is all sociological. And importantly, this is not necessarily a sociological or a political point. It really just follows from plain A to B to C logic.
Now, one thing that's interesting about your argument, it seems to me, is that you're really turning the whole notion of the biblical story of Babel on its head. I mean, go back to the book of Genesis, and that was seen as a great tragedy. It was kind of the fall when suddenly there were all these languages and people couldn't talk to each other. You are really celebrating this diversity of language.
Oh, yeah. It's really quite marvelous. You can read Stephen Jay Gould and you find out about all these bizarre and interesting creatures in the world, or E.O. Wilson and his arguments on behalf of diversity. And the linguist is often struck by the fact that things are exactly the same with language. We often are exposed to, say, French, German, maybe Russian, and it's easy to think that languages are all built on a certain basic game plan. You kind of jimmy with some things a bit, but really it's a matter of vocabulary and getting a feel of the language, and it always seems to us that other languages have a whole bunch of endings that we don't. But really, languages can be arranged to express even the mundanest of thoughts in ways that we would never really think of. In a lot of Native American languages, the way to say that somebody has a big house is to say, it house bigs her. And all of that will be one word just squished together. And for them, that's natural. It's not an idiom. That's just the way they tend to say almost everything. There are languages where the object comes first, the verb comes second, and the subject comes last. And that's their normal word order. All sorts of things that go on. So if you look at all 6,000, nobody's looked at all 6,000, but if you know what kind of variety there is out there, then you can see that there are all these beautiful systems out there, most of them now in danger, and they are as much a cause for wonder as the creatures of the world, or the cuisine of the world, or the art of the world.
Well, you cite a number of just amazing examples. For instance, some Australian languages apparently only have three verbs, and there are languages of New Guinea that have no tenses.
Very much so. And these people would be very surprised to see that there are languages that are different. There are languages in Australia where basically you can do and you can go and maybe you can be. And other than that, everything is a matter of combining one of those with a noun. So you don't sleep, you do a sleep. You don't hunt, but you do a hunt, and so on. And that's just the way it goes. Those are languages where nouns are just kind of favored. The idea of being able to distinguish I went and I had gone, or even I went, I have gone, and I had gone, that's kind of a European conceit. Once you step beyond Europe, that sort of thing is less common. And there are languages where there really is no particular need to situate everything you say in time. We think of that as something that's just natural to speaking, but really, you can imagine always using the present tense and having context take care of almost everything. And many languages know that. Now, it will also be that those same languages will attend to all sorts of things that we would never think needed any kind of marking in speech. And so there's always that issue as well. There are no ding-dong languages. But languages pick from a kind of a toolkit of what sorts of things they're going to bother to actually mark. And no language has everything. All languages have some.
You're really saying that complexity plays out differently in different languages. And to give another example of that, you cite a West African language called, I think it's Fula, that apparently has 16 genders.
Mm-hmm. Fula is just ridiculous. I mean, I don't, for anybody who speaks it, I probably am not using the right word. But going through a grammar of Fula, you really wonder how anybody could speak this without their head exploding. And the verbs are just as complicated as the nouns. There seem to be more exceptions than rules. Just an absolutely frightening language. And as far as Fula people go, Generally, a Fula speaker is, as often as not, a nomad. And these are not people who have great quantities of material goods. They are not people who have benefited in any real way from the global economy. So the complexity ends up being something that just kind of happens. Languages are full of what I often call a kind of elegant junk. And that's part of the fun of human languages around the world.
What do you mean, junk? What does it mean for a language to develop junk?
Well, with it, acknowledge that that's not a scientific term. What I mean by the junk is that languages are full of things that you really don't need. And so, for example, if I say, give me the soap, well, I didn't really need to say the, you know, especially given that we use language mostly orally. It's clear where the soap is and how the soap relates to the two of you. And yet, we've got this business in English of marking a versus the. That would surprise a lot of people in the world. For example, Slavs, who often have trouble with it, as you hear caricatured with Boris and Natasha on Rocky and Bullwinkle. But as we all know, that really is a problem for speakers of Slavic languages that don't have that. And so really, A and the, as give me the soap goes, are just junk. And so if you look at a language's grammar, a great deal of it is just there because languages have a way of seeping into spaces where they can go. But it seems to be more a matter of this sort of inexorable complexity of systems, which you can see analogs of throughout nature. There's this whole complexity theory growing, which I think linguistics should pay more attention to. But it's more that than indexing culture, and it's not even something that really corresponds to any particular need.
I take it you do not think much of those who would like to keep a language pure. Take English, for example, that there are certain, there's a right way to say it and there are rules of grammar and all of that.
It's all utterly and completely absurd. And the only way that that becomes clear is if you see all these things as random historical contingencies. It would have been very easy for a person when Fratton was around to say, well, what has happened to Latin? It's decayed. There are all these new words that have come in from these marauding Nordic Vikings. This is not a good language. Well, now we have people who are speaking French who consider it the most wonderful language in the world, and few people would be in a position to tell them exactly why it isn't. And the fact is that languages mix all over the world. We often tend to see languages mixing and think of it as a rather new situation, as a kind of a departure from a norm. But in fact, I don't think there's a language known that doesn't have at least mixture of vocabulary from other languages, and lots of it. And most languages in the world, even grammatically, show signs of having picked things up from other languages. And once you know that, then whenever you hear about English going to the dogs because of things changing or things coming in from other languages, you see that it's just business as usual and that language never goes to said dogs. You know, a language can die, but that's never recorded as having happened because it was just somehow a crummy, clunky, unsystematic language. Languages just keep it going.
John McWhorter is a linguist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of The Power of Babel. He spoke with Steve Paulson.